There will be lower jobs, lower incomes, lower investment in the United States. I think that's pretty much assured. Second is that this treaty will encourage American producers, American manufacturers, to try to compete in the world on the basis of low wages.
Certainly the company who moves, for example, to Mexico benefits by lowering its labor costs. It has higher profit margins. It can pay greater dividends to its shareholders. Its executives can get year-end bonuses. The workers who are displaced here in this country certainly don't benefit. And I'm hard-pressed to suggest any benefit for a Mexican worker who's being paid barely subsistence wages.
If we let our companies continue to move their production elsewhere as they seek lower wages and more lax environmental restrictions and other kinds of regulations, if we let that process continue, that puts us straight on that ladder downward.
They're really companies with no national origin anymore. They may have an origin, but they don't have a national allegiance.
Free trade, in essence, is about transferring power from governments to the market, i.e. to the corporations.
The media and the politicians have not been telling you about all the terrible things that can result because of the North American Free Trade Agreement. We'll try to rectify that right now on Alternative Views. Everyone's for freedom. Everyone's for free anything. Free trade sounds good, doesn't it? But who is going to pay for this free trade? We have an outstanding documentary by Howard Kling. He's going to tell us exactly the negative side of the North American Free Trade Agreement and what it can do to you, your job, the environment, and even democracy as we know it. But before we see our documentary, here are some news stories from the alternative press.
Well, George Bush is history, and I predicted correctly that he was going to lose the election after the second debate when I read the New York Times account of it, and I saw their op-ed page and who had come out against Bush. The headline read, "Issues, not attacks, dominate as audience guides second debate." The Times wrote that the president's original strategy for the second debate had been to follow up on Vice President Dan Quayle's very aggressive performance a couple nights before to raise the issue of whether the United States could trust Bill Clinton, making Clinton's character the issue in the election. But soon after the debate started and Bush started taking that tack, a woman in the audience complained that the amount of time the candidates have spent in their campaign trashing their opponent's character and their programs is depressingly large. And then another male person from the audience indicated that he was tired of the mudslinging and wished that the candidates would address the issues. Well, with only issues to address, Bush was lost. And the rest of his campaign floundered, and he lost the election. Now, I also saw that Bush was in serious trouble and was probably going to lose the election when I looked at the other stories in the newspaper that day. On the next page, there was a long story by the vice presidential candidate, Al Gore, attacking President Bush on his Iran-Contra policy and on the Iraq loan policy, the so-called Iraqgate, where Bush was loaning tremendous amounts of money to Saddam Hussein to help him build up his military. There was a detailed account of that. Then, on the next page, half of this page was covered with another story saying that the Bush administration was engulfed in disarray as Bush concentrates on the campaign, that the Bush administration was simply falling apart. They told about the war that was going on in the Bush administration between the FBI, the CIA, and the Justice Department. The FBI had not done all that Bush wanted in covering up the Iraqgate scandal. They'd been investigating too diligently that and other affairs that Bush administration officials were involved in. So the Bush administration turned on the FBI and said that its chief, William Sessions, had misused agency funds. Meanwhile, Sessions' wife was quoted in a Texas newspaper as saying that her husband, the head of the FBI, had been in a stupor brought on in part by political feuding between him and Bush appointees in other agencies.
More information keeps coming out about the backroom deals that allowed U.S. and British companies to secretly supply Saddam Hussein's armaments industry, even while there was limits supposedly being set on exports to that country. On November 4th, the New York Times reported that the U.S. Justice Department secretly agreed not to prosecute two top executives of Matrix Churchill Incorporated, a British company that supplied Iraq with millions of dollars in Western arms-making equipment. These directors were Gordon Cooper, who ran the company's Ohio operation, and Paul Henderson, managing director of Matrix Churchill's main operation in Coventry, England. Now, congressional critics, led by Representative Henry B. Gonzalez, a Democrat from Texas, have said that Matrix Churchill, along with other companies, were given export licenses for sensitive American technologies that had weapons, potential weapons uses, or were weapons-oriented, and also could be used for making weapons, even though American intelligence had information that identified that company as part of Iraq's arms procurement network. The problem is Geraldine Brill, the United States Attorney in Atlanta, said that these immunity agreements were necessary to get the executives to cooperate with the investigation of the multi-billion dollar Banco Nazionale del Lavoro scandal, which is also coming out of Atlanta. BNL was giving credits to Matrix Churchill, who was then using that money to buy up weapons-related technologies and send them to Iraq, all in contravention of U.S. law. But now the problem is the Justice Department, which agreed as early as 1990 and 1901 to grant these executives immunity, means that they can't even follow up on their own investigation, because these are the people that are responsible, and it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to prosecute them, even though they acted in total defiance of U.S. law. And it's the Bush administration which gave them that capacity and also gave them protection.
Moreover, there was a war going on between the Justice Department and the CIA, where the CIA was forced to admit that the Justice Department had told them to cover up evidence in the Iraqgate scandal, the extent to which the CIA did or did not know that the BNI bank was giving Iraq money that was being used by guns. The CIA said they knew nothing about this in the first inquiries, but then they admitted that the Justice Department told them to say that, and actually they knew quite a bit that was going on. The State Department, too, was in chaos, in which someone revealed that the Bush administration had been investigating the passport records of Bill Clinton. This is, of course, a highly political use of an agency that's not supposed to be given to these kinds of political wheelings and dealings. And finally, you could tell from this article that the Bush administration was falling apart, because Martin Anderson, a White House advisor in President Reagan's first term, sounded a warning note saying some people in the Bush administration have come to the conclusion that the president will probably lose, people on the inside, and they want to be the first rat off the sinking ship. And so all the Bush administration people were sending their job resumes out to try to get other jobs. But I knew for sure that Bush was going to lose the election when I looked at the op-ed page. There was a story in the right-hand corner by David Rockefeller, Jr., the chairman of Rockefeller Financial Services, that says why I trust Bill Clinton and gave 10 reasons why he's going to vote for Clinton. Well, if you lose the Rockefellers and the New York Times, you've lost pretty much the establishment and you're in some fairly serious trouble. There was another story on the op-ed page that day about Quailgate that was raising the question of who in the Bush campaign silenced Brett Kimmerlin, who, as you recall, was Quayle's drug dealer during the 1960s, who was in a federal prison, and in 1988 was going to hold a press conference to give the details of his regularly selling drugs to Dan Quayle in the 1960s. And the head of the federal prisons called the Oklahoma prison where Mr. Kimmerlin was, said that they had to cancel the press conference and kept Kimmerlin out for the next few years of the purview of the media. Well, it turns out that it was no less than James Baker who put the squeeze in on the federal prison system and kept Mr. Kimmerlin from the media. And finally, there was a story by Anthony Lewis, The Rot of Corruption, that talked about the Bush administration being one of the most corrupt institutions in history, and that during the political campaign, Lewis said, we see what an overweening love of power can do to a president and to the institutions of government. We are seeing the rot of corruption. Lewis was writing about the Justice Department that was trying to smother a prosecution that would show how President Bush covertly helped Saddam Hussein before the Persian Gulf War, and how the CIA and the FBI were, and the State Department were also compromised in the cover-up of this policy. There was also some new information about Bush and Iran-Contra. It appears that Barbara Bush was being interviewed on NBC one morning, and George walked right into the interview with Katie Couric of NBC, who immediately asked Bush, do you have knowledge of the Iran-Contra arms for hostages deal when you were vice president? And Bush said, well, I've testified 450 times under oath, some of them, and our staff, 350,000, that said yes. This is, of course, Bush speak. A moment later, Couric asked, you knew about the arms for hostage? And Bush answered, yes. And I said so all along, given speeches on it. Well, in point of fact, Bush had denied totally that he had any knowledge that there was ever an arms for hostage switch, whereas all kinds of documents had come out in the previous few weeks indicating that Bush knew exactly what was going on in that policy, and he lied about it. And on NBC television live, he admitted that he knew what was going on in that policy. So the next day, his lawyer had to come out and say that Bush misspoke. In any case, Lewis says that this was evidence of the corruption of the Bush administration. So when you've lost these many of the political establishment, you're going to lose the election. And that's what happened. The entire establishment, or significant sectors of it, just turned off on Bush, who was inefficient, corrupt, didn't deserve to be president, ran a sleazy campaign, and he lost.
In a recent publication of the alternative press magazine Extra, there was an article entitled Bush Distortions Taxing Journalists. And this was really interesting. At the end of 1988 elections between Dukakis and Bush, the journalists vowed to themselves to never allow the blatant lies that each candidate did set against the other. And in a way, they've upheld this vow, and in other ways, they've not. Bush is the one they attack most in this article. In the New York Times, August 7th, the New York Times, Andrew Rosenthal was challenging Bush's claim that Clinton unabashedly proposes the largest tax increase in American history, at least $150 billion over 4 years. Rosenthal pointed out that the Bush campaign was ignoring offsetting tax cuts proposed by Clinton, and he cited the Senate Budget Committee's calculation that Clinton's proposal would net the government an additional $92 billion, smaller than Reagan's $214 billion in 1982 and Bush's own hike of $137 billion in 1990. The Wall Street Journal followed up on Rosenthal's reporting, also noting that Bush's claim that Clinton had raised taxes 128 times was inaccurate. The 128 tax hikes claim was rebutted at length by Michael Kinsley in the New Republic. He pointed out that the 128 figure includes multiple errors and distortions, which include taxes that took up two lines on the pieces of paper were counted twice. Taxes were counted multiple times because they applied to more than one product, such as beer, wine, cigarettes, wine coolers. An extension of the dog racing season counted as a tax increase because the state would earn more revenue from betting, and so on. Both the Journal and Kinsley pointed out that if one is going to count individual taxes and fees, Reagan and Bush have raised taxes many more times than Clinton has. So despite the media outlets like New York Times, Wall Street Journal, New Republic, and Washington Post, which have actually upheld their vow to call the candidates on these lies, the mainstream media, for the most part, have not done this.
Well, you know, the Pope might have failed a drug detector test, a urine test, back in 1988. That's right, because when he was visiting Bolivia and Peru, he drank some coca leaf tea. It's a mild stimulant used as a coffee substitute down there, and is recommended for tourists suffering from altitude sickness or from fatigue. And Pope John had a couple of cups of it when he was in Bolivia in 1988. Well, the reason this is causing such a problem is that people can still bring it into the United States, and so people who particularly have lived in that part of the world, down Bolivia, Peru, and all, and have gotten used to it, is really a good remedy for a lot of things, as herbal tea. And so a lot of people who are drinking it now find that they're flunking their urine test. Now, this tea is accepted in South America all over. It's used by people all over Latin America. And the Bolivian government gets something like $215 million a year because of the sales of this coca leaf tea. And in Peru, a state-owned company has a monopoly on it. And both countries actually see this as a way to try to decrease the illegal cocaine trade. The American Medical Association Journal in 1986 warned, however, that just one cup of this mate de coco, as the tea is known, can result in a positive drug test for up to 26 hours thereafter. The tea is legal in the United States, but only after the cocaine itself is removed. But sometimes there can be a wee bit left in it, and so don't drink any of this tea. You better check your tea out before you go pee, and particularly pee for the man you're trying to get a job with. The Bolivian president said the use of coca leaf is an Andean tradition. The use of cocaine is a foreign habit.
We'll have time for some more news stories later in the program after we see our documentary, magnificent work by Howard Kling. The name of it is Free Trade, Who's Gonna Pay?
Been doing in a parallel conference here. Well, this is what you're doing. You present a document.
No, I'm not presenting it to you. I'm presenting it to somebody else as a go-between. I have talked to Mr. Wilson on the phone since I have been here directly. He has said that he was going to try to rearrange the schedule, and I'm simply asking you for the opportunity now to go. If you go back to him and ask him, can I please simply present this to him directly?
It's not possible. I'm sure it's not possible.
Is this your answer to public process and democracy? Is this what you're saying? Is this what goes on in Canada as well?
Finalmente, hace apenas unos días, se realiza el segundo encuentro sindical Intereses Comunes en México, donde participan sindicalistas de Estados Unidos y de Canadá.
We saw interest rates soar in this country. We saw Mexico, who couldn't repay its debt. We saw the IMF and the National Bank and the U.S. banks insisting that Mexico pay off the debt with interest, no forbearance, drove their economy into a ditch. And we saw the peso go from 26 to now 3,000. And rather than Mexico going up, what's going to happen is you're going to impoverish both sides of the border. You talked about jobs being created across the border.
If you could sum up the essence of the Canadian Free Trade Agreement and ultimately what we may have with the North American Free Trade Agreement, it would be three things. Greater market access, more secure market access, and allowing market forces to work. If those three things can be put in place, then the kind of benefits that flow from them are increased trade and investment, more jobs, lower prices, and greater competitiveness at home and abroad than we would have had absent such an agreement.
I think it offers opportunities for all three countries. I think for the Canadians, the chance to specialize and have access to the U.S. market is the biggest plus. They've already got that, but now they have to protect it by being part of this agreement. I think for Mexico, this is truly a revolutionary agreement. It offers them the opportunity to make their entire growth strategy permanent.
The promises of free trade, growth, jobs, stability, prosperity for all, are these real? Or will there be winners and losers? Who will gain and who's going to pay? The answer depends largely on your place in the economic equation. Transnational stockholder or hourly wage earner? Successful CEO or displaced worker? The current push for free trade was unveiled by President Bush in June of 1990 with the Enterprise for the Americas initiative. Chief among its objectives was the creation of a hemispheric free trade zone for the flow of goods, services, and capital. 1 year later, and despite opposition from organized labor and others, Congress granted fast-track authority for negotiating and implementing a North America free trade agreement with Mexico as an important step in the Bush initiative. With remarkably little press attention, the debate has raged ever since.
People don't understand. The risks here are enormous. The first risk is that there will be lower jobs, lower incomes, lower investment in the United States. I think that's pretty much assured. Second is that this treaty will encourage American producers, American manufacturers, to try to compete in the world on the basis of low wages.
Companies face opportunities, and in some cases it may well be that the products are more efficiently produced in Mexico. So what we get is a change in the pattern of specialization. The United States loses labor-intensive kinds of activities, and what it gains are the more high-paying, skill-intensive kinds of activities. That's, I think, what happens in trade with a developing country like Mexico. And that's why it's beneficial for the United States, because it allows us to upgrade our labor force.
You know, it's a little difficult to tell a GM worker in Kokomo who was making $16, $17 an hour, and now those jobs, 3,000 of them, are down in Matamoros or Reynosa, and people working for 59 cents an hour, it's a little difficult to tell him he isn't a loser.
Certainly the company who moves, for example, to Mexico benefits by lowering its labor costs. It has higher profit margins. It can pay greater dividends to its shareholders. Its executives can get year-end bonuses. The workers who are displaced here in this country certainly don't benefit. And I'm hard-pressed to suggest any benefit for a Mexican worker who's being paid barely subsistence wages.
As many as 60% of the Mexican labor force working for U.S. corporations are paid around $4 a day. Compensation rarely goes higher than $10 per day. This situation has been made worse by a major devaluation of the peso and a resulting drop in buying power.
Oh, they are tremendously lower. It's just no comparison. These are probably a fourth or a fifth of what they are here in the United States.
It's important to bear in mind that low wages are a real attractive factor for companies considering a move to Mexico. And the fact that the Mexican labor force is very willing to train and to perform well. But in addition, companies can be given subsidies like cheap electrical rates, virtually no payment for sewage, access to industrial parks. All these things are very important to a company. They may be able to avoid occupational health and safety regulations that they would find binding here in the United States. They can avoid ecological constraints, environmental constraints, and of course taxes can be lessened or all but eliminated based upon a move to Mexico.
If we let our companies continue to move their production elsewhere as they seek lower wages and more lax environmental restrictions and other kinds of regulations, if we let that process continue, that puts us straight on that ladder downward. All of our experience, all of our past experience with trade liberalization in the past has shown that workers who are displaced by trade move down the job ladder, that they end up taking lower paying jobs, lower skilled jobs, and that there's nothing in this agreement so far that we've seen that any of the negotiators have told us about that will indicate that it's any different.
All phases of manufacturing are going to be greatly affected, and when that happens, of course, the entire stability of the country is going to be affected. And so we're not talking simply about union workers or auto workers. We're talking about all manufacturing, which of course then equates to an erosion of the tax base, services that we have in this country, a horrible impact on families and communities, you name it.
We've got to look at this free trade agreement very critically in terms of what it means for the future of the economy and society in the United States. We're going to have a closer relationship with Mexico. We ought to have a positive one, not one that weakens our industry, weakens Mexico's ability to advance its wage structure and its social benefits, and undermines the environment.
I wanted to go down to Mexico, where dollars spend lower and lower, cause the peso's falling lower and lower. Oh, her name is Annalisa. She works to feed her family. She makes $5 a day. The peso drops, her money dwindles. She feels the squeeze. She wants to know.
The concern that somehow a North American free trade agreement is going to result in a massive shift of U.S. jobs and plants to Mexico is misplaced. It's just not going to happen for a variety of reasons. Anybody who wanted to move a plant to Mexico and operate under a free trade environment could have done so any time in the last 25 years under the Maquilador program.
Especially since the late 1980s, U.S. companies have taken increasing advantage of the maquiladora zones on the U.S.-Mexican border. Under this arrangement, parts and components are shipped to Mexican workers who assemble them for re-export to the U.S. free of tariffs and duties.
In a way, I think the Maquiladora program, because it has been a form of free trade, is something of a paradigm for the economics that one could expect in the context of a North American free trade agreement. Inherent in it is the notion of production sharing and of harnessing the complementary aspects of our respective economies to our mutual benefit.
That program has engendered tremendous capital investment from the United States to Mexico, averaging 10 to 15% a year over the last 8 years. Currently, there are some 500,000 Mexican workers employed in some 1,200 factories producing goods that are exported solely to the U.S. market. This is what Bush and Salinas want to see more of. So it's useful for us to take a look at the Maquila program and see exactly what has happened. Frequently, you have shiny new plants, state-of-the-art production techniques, and workers that are being paid 60 cents an hour. Those workers frequently are working a 48-hour week, and after work, they go home to colonias, usually adjacent to the plant, where because of their low income, because of their poverty, are forced to live in shacks made out of plywood and cardboard, communities that have one water spigot for 200 families, communities that have no sewers, no electricity. The kinds of things that economic textbooks tell us should come about because of this economic activity, schools, parks, hospitals, housing, has not taken place. And it's there for everyone to see.
Actualmente tenemos 6 millones de desempleados y 12 millones de subempleados, bueno, ante una competencia, ¿no? Fuerte en
Presently we have 6 million unemployed and 12 million underemployed workers. What sort of investment is this that's coming to Mexico through the maquiladoras? In recent years, the investment has been mostly speculative. The maquiladoras have created about 450,000 jobs. With 1 million entering the labor force in Mexico every year, the creation of 450,000 jobs in 25 years is not very significant. What is that really doing?
Frente a 1 million de trabajadores que se incorporan cada año a la población económicamente activa, 450,000 empleos en 25 años es algo realmente poco significativo.
Con el Tratado de Libre Comercio se teme una mayor
With this free trade agreement, there's a fear among the workers that there'd be a great increase in unemployment among workers, particularly in small and medium-sized industries, as those industries would not have the financial capability to modernize their plants and be competitive.
De cerrar porque la embestida en cuanto a los productos que vengan del exterior van a ser fuertes.
Do you realize that when a large American industry goes in and creates 1,000 jobs, they probably displace 2,000 traditional Mexican industries? And so now what you have then is you have 2,000 workers competing for 1,000 jobs, which of course effectively drives down wages. So they're not actually creating jobs there at all. They're actually displacing workers.
The risk involved when government enacts this free trade agreement, turning its back on the workers and not considering them, is that it deepens the economic and social inequality that exists here in Mexico.
The transnationals are not very favorable towards the workers because, while they bring in all this advanced technology, this technology, therefore, means that there's less labor needed. We'll be like one great big maquiladora.
In practical effect, the free trade agreement will give the privileges of the maquiladora program to foreign investors who would operate anywhere in the country.
Entonces, este tratado que se negocia no es el que conviene al país.
This agreement that's being talked about now is not one that will be good for Mexican development. It's not one that's going to solve our critical social problems. So this is not the sort of investment that's going to push for more Mexican development. In 1989, the investment was about 70% in subsidiaries of the United States rather than in Mexican development. What this agreement really signifies is subordination of Mexico on one side of the agreement and an international economic order based on concentration of investments on the other side. This agreement will result in the demand for greater authoritarianism, and it will be anti-democratic.
Ha exigido, y lo hemos sentido de manera directa, acrecentar el autoritarismo, la represión y la antidemocracia en el terreno político.
Las condiciones miserables y las arbitrariedades a que nos someten las compañías, la corrupción sin límites, el gangsterismo y hasta el asesinato por parte de algunas centrales obreras, la impunidad con que se cometen estos hechos.
We are subjected by the companies to bad working conditions and arbitrary treatment, unbounded corruption, mafia-like activity, including killings by some labor organizations, which they carry out with impunity.
Los compañeros de la planta de Cuautitlán en el Estado de México de la fábrica Ford.
The workers at the Cuautitlán factory were simply working for internal democracy within their plant. They were trying to elect their own union leaders. At the end of this effort, 800 people were out of work. One person was dead, many were injured, and the union efforts were greatly crushed. And we had the case not only at Ford, but there are other cases similar to this.
Principalmente, el principal problema es la cuestión sindical.
The problem is that the central union figures don't really let us organize like we would like to be able to in order to struggle for our rights. These would include higher salaries, to be able to get loans, and above all, to address questions about environmental concerns in Chihuahua, Juarez, and other places.
There's no real democratic liberty among the labor unions here in Mexico. And so the government controls the central officials of the union. It doesn't allow for individuals really to associate freely with the unions of their choice.
The role of the unions is seen rather differently also by the employers. The employers like to team up with the official unions to avoid radical movements in their companies, because then these unions take care of this radical element.
There's really only one sector that benefits, and that's the owners and the managers of multinational corporations. They're the ones who have the large pools of capital for investment, and they want to invest it with as little restriction and accountability as they can, and hence this free trade deregulation and privatization strategy that they have embarked on. And it really, what it winds up doing is that it forces people, workers, and communities to compete with each other for ever-decreasing standards, such as wages and so on, in order to attract the investment.
What this free trade agreement about is about stability of policy. It's not about immediate impact. Well, people are afraid in the future, potential investors in Mexico, are afraid of instability of these laws about foreign ownership. You got a factory there, you lose it like that, maybe you're afraid to invest in Mexico.
The main driving force, of course, is that the transnationals don't like Mexico's investment law. Mexico had one of the most restrictive foreign investment laws, officially implemented in 1973. And particularly after the 1988 election, when they saw very clearly that, that Cardenas either lost by an eyelash or actually won by an eyelash, they again realized how unstable is the underlying political situation in Mexico. So what they want is something in concrete. And the free trade agreement gives them this. The free trade agreement will make it impossible for the Mexican government subsequently to change that foreign investment law.
The financial markets, the investors, are not waiting for this agreement to be signed. The corporations and corporate strategists are not waiting for this agreement to be signed. They are already planning their mergers, their acquisitions, their foreign investment on the basis of what they expect to happen.
General Motors is the largest employer in Mexico. Few people understand it, but that's a fact. Right behind them, General Electric. And so Ford is down there, Chrysler has plants down there, as I said, GM has plants down there. Not just parts plants, but assembly plants, transmission plants, engine plants.
Almost all of the investment that is in Mexico and will be going
into Mexico are from the 100 or 200 largest companies in the United States. And much of what they do is simply making a part in Mexico, and it fits into global production.
Absent that agreement, or those arrangements, imports would continue to come into the United States. They would likely be of wholly foreign origin, likely from the Far East. Therefore, there would be no U.S. jobs producing components, no Mexicans jobs assembling the components into finished products, and a lose-lose proposition.
Yet many of these so-called overseas companies are U.S.-based transnationals. In fact, one-third to one-half of all imports coming into the United States are transactions between domestic and foreign branches of the same conglomerate. While those companies have prospered, communities have suffered in the U.S., Mexico, and Canada.
It's global. I mean, we've lost jobs to Singapore. We've lost jobs to Hong Kong. You know, at one time, every telephone manufactured virtually in the world was manufactured in the United States. You can't find a telephone, a residential or business type set, that's made in the United States anymore.
Indeed, the increasing ability of transnational corporations and capital to shift production at will around the globe creates new pressures on working people and their communities.
I really don't think it's accurate any longer to refer to Canadian companies, Canadian transnational companies, and American transnational companies. They're really companies with no national origin anymore. They may have an origin, but they don't have a national allegiance. They invest wherever they get the best return, and they invite people, workers, and communities to compete with each other to provide the best investment package to the company, and that's usually in the form of lower wages, lower environmental standards, lower governmental standards of all kinds.
They run away, they run away, they run away to sunny skies and watch their profits rise. They run away, they run away, they run away to sunny skies and watch their profits rise. Workers over there treated like slaves just because a shop ran away. Workers over there have no rights. We've got the same struggle, we've got the same fight. They run away, they run away, they run away to sunny skies and watch their profits rise. They run away, they run away, they run away to sunny skies and watch their profits rise.
Now, one of the outcomes of the free trade agreement has been that as because Canada has so many branch plants, and because the United States has a huge market, and because so much of our industry is owned by Americans, quite frankly, many of our industries immediately after the free trade agreement was signed moved south.
In 1988, the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement was negotiated and signed by the two governments, a major step in Bush's hemispheric initiative. Like the Maquiladora program, it offers another vivid glimpse into life under free trade.
Our experience for 3 years since its inception has been that we have not experienced prosperity, and that we have experienced a very substantial net job loss in the area of 400,000 jobs, actually. To understand the impact of that for the United States, you can multiply that figure by 10, since our economies and our populations are approximately a ratio of 1 to 10 with each other. So we have been devastated rather heavily as a result of free trade.
About two-thirds of the jobs being lost in the free trade era are being lost due to permanent plant closures. In 1982, only 22% of the jobs lost were due to permanent plant closures. So there's a real good clue that it's a different kind of restructuring.
And we are now seeing the same process in Quebec, where, for instance, furniture industry is suffering a lot from the from the agreement.
Free trade, in essence, is about transferring power from governments to the market, i.e. to the corporations. And that's, in the Canadian case, that's really significant because governments have traditionally played a very important role in Canadian life and Canadian economic life.
That transfer of power has had significant consequences.
Well, under the Free Trade Agreement, we're not allowed, the Canadians are no longer allowed to have any publicly run system of anything, like automobile insurance, for example. We're not allowed to create any new ones without providing compensation to any American firms who may be hurt by it.
All the time the officials are saying to us, yes, but there is the free trade agreement and we must look if we can act in conformity of the agreement.
Things that we did not think possible a few years ago are happening before our very eyes. No Canadian would have thought that our Medicare system was in any great danger. Mulroney promised us that it was a sacred trust, and indeed there are vehicles through the restructuring happening that will very much endanger that system.
The social programs in Canada and many of our public services in Canada, which were once the responsibility of a national government, are now going to be transferred and decentralized to provincial and municipal governments, which means we will no longer have a national set of standards regarding social programs.
The individual provinces in Canada will be solely responsible for funding a healthcare system. Most provinces won't be able to do that. So we're certainly looking at the potential of having the end of our Medicare system in Canada as a result of free trade.
The free trade deal has been an unmitigated disaster for Canadians. It is a charter of rights and freedoms for transnational corporations which undermines the sovereignty of democratically elected governments.
Mr. Wilson, Tony Clark.
Tony, how are you?
I want to present to you the results of the discussions and deliberations regarding how to go about an alternative approach to continental development. And
I think what we need in place of free trade is fair trade. And somehow or another, we have to establish standards for the North American continent that unify the standards, not separate them. And that goes all the way from the right to strike, the right to bargain, the right to have safe and healthy working conditions. And to do that, we have to be able to have an interchange between the unions and the workers in the different countries. And I see that as probably the first step that has to be done, where we start to build some real ties with the Canadian and the Mexican workers.
We can no longer operate within the borders of our own country. Corporations don't operate like that today. They're faceless, nameless multinationals that have the flexibility to move capital wherever they want to.
There should be no boundaries for workers. If we're ever going to be successful, we have to take down the boundaries and the barriers and just have trade union movement amongst workers.
Watching Alternative Views, originating from Austin, Texas. Let's return now to the Alternative Press for some more news stories.
There was a frightening story in Mother Jones how Bush manipulated regulators to cover up impending bank failures before the election. Now, this may be deja vu to those of you who have watched Alternative Views, because during the 1988 presidential election, the Republicans also covered up the impending SNL crisis. whereas right after the election, the Bush administration had news that the taxpayers had a big burden to assume because of all the savings and loans that were failing. In the very months before the 1988 election, the Bush-Reagan administration had said that impending rumors of an SNL collapse were a myth. The administration's top SNL regulator, Mr. Danny Wall, promised that losses would not exceed $30 billion and that the Federal Savings and Loans Insurance Corporation would have the money to cover all of these losses and that the taxpayers wouldn't have to kick in for a bailout. Well, 2 weeks after George Bush was sworn into office, the same Mr. Danny Wall announced that SNL losses could exceed $100 billion and the taxpayers would have to shoulder most of the cost. There's even estimates that it may be as much as $600 billion before it's all over. Well, the same thing happened in the 1992 election, except that it had to do with the banking system. Although there were rumors that 1,069 banks in the United States were on the Federal Reserve's so-called problem list, and that these banks had over $600 billion in assets and could collapse, this was covered over during the election, that the Bush administration manipulated it so that these statistics didn't get into the public. In 1987, the Federal Deposit Insurance Fund for banks was running on an $18.3 billion surplus. But there were so many failures that this had been totally exhausted. So as 1992 began and the election was taking off, basically the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation for banks was broke. Well, what the Bush administration did in December 1991, they called in 464 banking officials to Baltimore for an extraordinary meeting with Nicholas Brady and other top economists in the Bush administration. And basically, they told these people that they'd been regulating the banks too rigorously, and this was causing a lot of problems. So they should lay off of the regulation, lay off of investigations of failing banks, and just cool it, trying to make these bank regulators the scapegoats for the economic problems. Well, this intimidated the bank regulators, who simply didn't really do any investigations into the failing banks during 1992. Rumors came into Congress that many banks were about to collapse and that banks were in a very shaky situation, but they still didn't have really the figures. Now, to bail out the banks in 1992, the Bush administration turned to Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan, who's supposed to be a non-political, independent regulator of the economy. But Greenspan is obviously a Bush appointment and a supporter. So he slashed the interest rates. That meant that passbook savings went down to as little as 3%. You might have noticed that you're only getting 3% for money market certificates or 3% for your savings in the banks. Well, this is a bonanza for the banks because, as Mother Jones points out, they can take your money and put it in long-term federal bonds for 7% or more, and thus they make 3 or 4% of profit right off the top. So this was a bonanza for banks that basically saved many from going under this year during the election that would have been very, very costly for Bush. Needless to say, it was costly for you, the public, that didn't get the interest on your savings or your money market certificates that you would have gotten otherwise. Well, the bill is still to pay because this influx of cash into banks is only a short-term problem, a short-term solution to the problem. And so right around the corner, we may have the biggest bank failure in history. This could be, Mother Jones says, a post-election booby prize for the Clinton administration. They estimate that the collapse of banks could be anywhere between $70 billion and $600 billion. And guess who is going to pay for it? They also indicate that this problem could have been solved if Bush would have addressed it in 1992. They could have gone for a solution to this problem. Likewise, they say in 1985, when Congress first noticed that the S&L industry was melting down, the cost of fixing the mess was estimated to be about $15 billion. And so by the 1988 election, the bill had swollen to over $167 billion and now is in the hundreds of billions of dollars. So we might be having a replay of the S&L failure with bank failures, and the same dynamics could have prevented it. That is, had the Bush administration addressed the issue earlier, there might have been a solution forthcoming, but instead they were embarrassed by this because of the election, and they did everything possible to sweep it under the...
Have you seen in the past several months, there are wonderful headlines saying, oh, the savings and loan industry is now healthy, they're having record profits. Well, no wonder. You remember that we've told you over the past that the Resolution Trust Corporation let these investors come in and cherry-pick all the good, profitable investments and leave the unprofitable ones or less profitable ones to the government, meaning you and I, to pay for. Well, here's just an example of from January of 1992. The House Banking Committee announced that there were hundreds of millions of dollars of office buildings and hotels that were just practically given away at discount prices to a new group of investors called Patriot American Investors, LP. They're a group of Canadian and Americans. This outfit, Patriot, was only going to have to buy some of the properties the government that it wanted, and the government keep the rest. But it would buy at only 60% of appraised value, financed by government loans that require no interest for 7 years. Now, the government is entitled to a tiny fraction of any profit that the Patriot gets, but the investors are able to abandon properties that go sour and give them back to the government. So they can't lose. No wonder the savings and loan industry is doing so well. There was someplace somebody said, well, we do have the New Deal. The right-wingers and the Republicans criticized the New Deal, but during Reagan Bush, they did have a New Deal, but it was only for the wealthy.
And that's the end of this Alternative Views. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We would like to thank Howard Kling in Minneapolis for letting us use his documentary on free trade. Also, our camera person, Eric Eubank, audio, Kevin L. West, editing assistance by Ashley Blake. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You want to jot that down? Drop us a line. We'd like to hear from you. Goodbye.